there's a story that my dad tells, which is I'm 3 years old and he's giving me a bath and I start singing Lovely Ladies, which is a bunch of prostitutes, you know? And so my dad was like, maybe we don't listen to Les Mis in front of Emily.
Maybe we're good for now.
Yeah, because she's retaining all of this.
Hello and welcome back to the Ear Fuel podcast. As always, I'm Joel Freemark, and you can follow me on Twitter at @GetEarFuel and at The Daily Guru. The podcast is always available in the iTunes and Google Play stores under Ear Fuel and at GetEarFuel.com. What you heard at the top was part of my conversation with the brilliantly talented Emily Danger. We sat down the other week to discuss her new solo project that premieres today, as well as her overall musical journey and lots of other stuff. But before we get into that, a very quick album review. The album I want to check out today is called Skeleton Tree, and it's the brand new release from Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. Now, this is their 16th release and their first since 2014's Push the Sky Away, an album that, for me, was a bit disappointing. I know a lot of people disagree, but didn't love that one. But this is Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds we're talking about, so whenever they put out an album, you must give it a spin. They're one of the most consistently creative and outright awesome bands ever, and in so many ways, I really think they're getting better with age. Now, there's some pretty heavy backstory to this album, but I want to talk about the music before I get to that, as the backstory really does color things pretty strong, and there's a lot to say before we even get there. On nearly every song here, I found myself writing the same two words, heartbreakingly beautiful. But the magic here is that they managed to achieve that sound and feel across a wide range of atmospheres and tempos. It's not like they just get to that and let it sustain itself for the whole album. It's really cool. Now granted, this album is on the slower side for the most part, but it's the various small sonic touches they put on each song that makes this a sort of record you just can't stop listening to. The opening of Jesus Alone has this eerie, almost radar-like sound that eases you into things, and from minimalist moments like the song Magneto, to the feel of impending doom on I Need You, to the almost church-like distant sky, this is about as musically gorgeous a record as you'll find. On every song, the music is outright exceptional. You're completely pulled in and captivated by it, and really, you have to hear this one firsthand to fully get how good it is. But that leads us to one of the hard truths on this album. There really isn't a moment of levity or light anywhere. Usually, Nick will give us some little bit of tongue-in-cheek or a super clever phrase, but this record is unrelenting sadness. Even with the final two tracks that are a bit cathartic, it's a rough one on the heart, but with good reason. So, the backstory. The band started recording this record in late 2014, and it continued well into 2015. On July 14th, just as the recording sessions were wrapping, Nick's 15-year-old son died after falling off a cliff. Needless to say, the sessions were suspended and didn't resume until earlier this year. Now, with that bit of understanding, you can make the case that Skeleton Tree was all written after this tragedy, at least insofar as the lyrics are concerned. It's an album of mourning and loneliness and grief, and that emanates from every corner of the record, both musically and lyrically. Nick doesn't sing as much as he usually does, and the dejected, almost exhausted sound that he brings at times fits perfectly with the mood the band is setting. It's the stillness here, the fragility of these songs that's so haunting, yet so right on. It's magical in a very dark way. Tracks like Girl in Amber and I Need You are pure heartbreak through and through, with the former being without question one of the heaviest tracks ever recorded. It's beyond words and is not for casual listening. In so many ways, this is as raw and open as you'll find anywhere, with Nick completely bearing his soul in pain on every song. I mean, even without the knowledge of the backstory, the album is just devastating. But you also can't help but be left in awe of the stunning sonic aesthetic. Again, the last two tracks do offer a small catharsis, and it's more than fitting that the final lines of the record are, "And it's all right now," and Distant Sky, the song Distant Sky, it's outright angelic. There's no getting past the pain on every second of this album, but there are few people that can craft beauty and tragedy better than Nick Cave. Skeleton Key is not only one of his finest musical moments, but honestly, it's one of the most touching and impressive records ever. Go spend some time with this one, but make sure you have some tissues nearby. Moving on. Over the last few years, there aren't many artists who have fascinated me as much as Emily Danger. Her songs mix wonderfully unique orchestrations with absolutely stunning vocal work. And along with this, she's one of the coolest people you're going to find. Really. Here's a quick clip from her last EP. So that version of the band called it quits, and her first solo track premieres today over on Bitch Media, so go check that out for sure. And yeah, we sat down the other day to talk about the new song, old songs, carrying amps, all sorts of stuff. So sit back and get to know Emily Danger. What was really funny is I just got into my head the last time I interviewed you, because it was in the back of a van.
In the old van. I
miss like
it.
2012 or something?
It was like our first album.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was 2012.
Yeah, and so that band, there were a lot of people in that band.
There were five of us.
Uh-huh.
That's a huge band.
That was a big band.
Yeah, too many.
And a very different sound.
Yes,
That was a very different sound.
Yeah, extremely different.
How did that band come about?
Well, that band started with me and Ryan Nierhoff, the guitar player who eventually turned drummer.
Uh-huh.
And he, one of my best friends still to this day, but he is unfortunately in California now. But we started the band because we were tired of auditioning, basically, for shows.
Sure.
And,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
operas and things like that. But we just both wanted kind of a creative outlet. So he and I started the band, me on keys, and he was on guitar at the time. And then we both said, you know what instrument we like? We like violin. So
sure,
we put out a general call on Facebook, like you do. And here comes Cameron.
Hey, friends, does anyone know a violinist?
Does anyone own a violin and can maybe play five
convincingly
notes? Yeah.
Yeah.
And miraculously, Cameron appears, and uh-huh, he can play, obviously, more than five notes.
Just a bit.
Just a few, and more than five instruments. And then the three of us hit it off. And then we needed a drummer. And one of my dear friends at a bar that I used to go to happened to know drums and bass.
Mm-hmm.
So he came along. And then we put out a general call for a bass player because we moved Colin, who was at the time on bass, over to drums. And then Coyote came along. So it was just like a big Facebook free-for-all.
Sure.
Basically.
Sure.
Of friends of friends. But all actually really talented musicians in their own right. But, you know, like most bands, it just didn't last very long.
Move closer. So that band only lasted,
I would say, a year.
Okay.
We were together about a year, and we did that huge tour.
Uh-huh.
And all right, got the van together and did the first album pretty much together.
Mm-hmm.
But then, like, natural things happened and people move and people,
it's like the Roots said, things fall apart.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But nothing dramatic. Mm-hmm. It was all very amicable, and I still very much love all those guys. So it was, it just became easier with less cooks in the kitchen.
Sure. So that was the end of that band. Was that
yes,
technically Emily Danger Band?
I,
or was that a band with no name or a rotating name?
It was always Emily Danger.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I couldn't get the website Emily Danger. That belongs to a dominatrix.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. If you're in Chicago and you're looking for some S&M, call up Emily Danger and tell her to give me the username.
Damn
please.
It. So Emily Danger V1 comes to an end.
That comes to an end. So that, I guess you could say, was Emily Danger Band, because mm-hmm, A, it was a band.
Sure.
And B, that was our website URL at the time, because I couldn't get Emily Danger.
Mm-hmm.
So Coyote and Colin kind of go their own way. And it's me, Ryan, and Cameron, basically. And then Ryan makes the decision to move to California. And then it's basically Cameron and myself. And this is kind of where an important thing comes in, which is Ableton Live.
Uh-huh.
And learning how to produce and learning how to make drum beats. Because
Making some sick beats. Yeah.
And Cameron was the first to learn the program. And then eventually I caught on. So now it's just me and Ricky Watts, my fantastic drummer who plays with me live. But Cam now does his own thing and uses Ableton Live and uses beats and stuff, and it's incredible. So we all kind of like grew together like a lovely tree, and then grew our own little branches, you know? But we're all still friends. I still drink with Cam and we have fun.
So you got you two, the two of you, you and Cameron.
Yeah.
Certainly had a musical connection.
Definitely.
That led to some pretty wild creativity. How were those writing sessions? Would one of you come to the table and say, here's what I've got? Or was it kind of all in the moment?
It was, I would come with lyrics and a melody and just a general chord progression. And then we would call Cameron the mad scientist. He would come in and just like come up with something. Like, for instance, in Deflate, he came up with a he comes up with these hooks that are just fantastic. And so that really added a ton, I think, to Peace Arch EP, the second EP. And that's kind of like the great progression was we basically turned Cameron loose on that EP. And I love that album. I'll never regret it. But what's coming next is extremely different.
And we'll get to extremely different in a minute. Because we kind of, because of my own curiosity, entered, we kind of walked into the movie halfway through. So you have this extraordinary talent and a wide appreciation for all sorts of music.
Yeah.
What were your musical roots like? What sort of music did you grow up with?
My mom, when she was pregnant with me, put James Taylor in headphones and like put it to her belly.
Sure.
So James Taylor was like, I was born into listening to James Taylor basically. And then from there you get kind of some classical influences because my mom always loved opera. She loved Kathleen Battle, musicals. Les Miserables was a common theme in our house. There's a story that my dad tells, which is I'm 3 years old and he's giving me a bath and I start singing Lovely Ladies, which is a bunch of prostitutes, you know? And so my dad was like, maybe we don't listen to Les Mis in front of Emily.
Maybe we're good for now.
Yeah, because she's retaining all of this. So it's like a huge array of musicals and opera and then classic rock. So it was like this very weird, which I think you can hear actually in our music, is like troubadours mixed with classical and jazz. Mm-hmm. It's very bizarre. Mm-hmm. But as a result, as being a huge James Taylor fan, lyrics were always very important to me. Just really, that came first and foremost to me.
Did you write as a youngin?
As a youngin, I picked up a guitar when I was 15 and I wrote songs that I'm sure I should never remember again because I'm sure they were horrendous. I did write...
Heartbroken 15-year-old.
Oh, just so many heartbreaks. Yep. I did write this song on the piano. It was all instrumental and it was called Rain.
Okay.
And what it was just descending thirds. No like key really, but it did, I gotta tell you, it did sound like Rain. So
but it was an idea.
It was an idea.
You're just like, you know what, this may not be your idea of art, man.
Yeah,
but I like it.
I was really pushing musical boundaries at age 10.
I mean, it's pretty wild.
Yeah. So I did. I toyed with writing and I wrote a little in college when I got a little better at guitar, but I didn't really do it actively until about, I'd say, 5 years ago.
So then you went to college.
Went to college.
And what did you do in college musically?
I studied classical voice.
Okay.
I have a degree in classical voice. And that was just doing a bunch of other people's music. But it's very time consuming.
Absolutely.
So I did a ton of musicals, operas, which I thought I loved. So I pursued opera when I moved here and went to Manhattan School of Music. And I did that for about 2 years. And then when I left, I was like, you know, don't really love this. So that's when I started writing.
Because when I first heard your music many, many years ago, one of the most intriguing things to me was there is this very well-trained, polished, classical tone to your voice.
Right.
And yet we're dealing with elements of electronic and experimental and hip-hop and even tones of heavy metal here and there. And
right.
That it's this very interesting clash of sounds.
Yeah.
How do you bridge those in your mind, at least?
I really try to serve the lyrics and the melody as best I can. And I think, to be honest, that's where some conflict came with the band, because everyone has their own ideas and they bring them to the table. And sometimes I think I can admit that a lot of the arrangements overshadowed the melodies and the lyrics. Mm-hmm. So how I would bridge it was, I would be like, you know, first and foremost, this is the main instrument in this band is voice, and it needs to be heard. And these lyrics need to be heard because they're very important to me. So yeah. It would go like, if you're looking at it like a pyramid, it would go voice and lyrics at the top, and then violin being the, probably like the lead guitar mm-hmm. replacement, and then drums and rhythmic elements, and then everything else underneath, basically trying to support the voice.
Sure. Which I think is something that not many music fans in a way consider, or bands realize, that they see the vocalist as the vocalist,
right?
And kind of not in a really weird way, maybe not a musical member of the band.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. Well, I grew up in church, so everyone was, the phrase that was constantly on repeat was, your voice is your instrument. Mm-hmm. You know, you need to take care of it. And nowadays, even when I play in the wedding band with these phenomenal kind of jazz musicians, they always tell me, your voice is like an instrument unto itself. And when you're singing, the other instruments try to come up to meet it, basically. So I don't, I'm not saying that in like a, look at me, but
the instruments follow me.
Follow my instrument. But I've always considered the human voice as an instrument to be, you know, honed and trained and given to the world.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that I think is what a lot of people don't get about an artist like Björk.
Oh, absolutely.
Where they don't realize that yeah. what she takes that to the extreme.
Yeah.
That, yeah, she's singing, but also makes all of these different noises and sounds.
Yes.
And tries to give it different texture where other singers, and it's not that they're bad.
Yeah.
I'm not going to slam someone like, let's pick someone else I love. Liz Phair, who I love.
Yeah, she's great.
Great singer.
Yeah.
It's a different approach to what you can use your voice as.
Totally. I think that her, like, well, I think 90s music is a good example where the voice mixes with the instruments and they're all like together. But very rarely, I think, does the voice rise above the
yeah.
music.
Yeah, it's part of the band.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a good description of it.
Not necessarily a bad thing.
No.
So now that we've packaged this all together, you mentioned that to you the lyrics are one of the most important things.
Yes.
Where do you get your lyrics from?
Well, it's a wide variety. It's hard to not be personal because that's the type of person I am. I'm pretty open. And so a lot of my lyrics come from personal experience and tortures and triumphs. But also, like, a lot of it comes from the news, what's happening in our current political climate. There's a lot of my lyrics that are veiled as maybe a personal struggle when really it's like the struggle of all females, mm-hmm. you know? So there's like a lot of feminist undertones and frustrations in my music. And then I try to mold them both together, basically. I think I want to have as many people as possible relate to what I'm saying. So I don't get too personal.
You have your intent behind it, but
yeah.
also try and leave it open for interpretation to other
yeah.
people.
There's a lot of metaphor. Mm-hmm. It's a journey and metaphor, my music.
Journey and metaphor. That sounds like some like indie bands, like their,
yes.
their first album, Journey and Metaphor.
Yeah. And there's like a sitar in it.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah. yeah. And it's really subtle on one track. And that's the big moment.
Yeah. yeah.
So you mentioned a lot of it is feminist and things like that.
Yeah.
A horribly generic question.
Sure.
What's it like being a woman fronting a band in 2016?
Oh, yeah. I have had a pretty positive experience. There's definitely been moments, you know, like I think I said this the last time that we spoke, where like I would carry a guitar amp into a venue and people would be like, oh, you're so strong. You know, you know, and I'd be like, yeah, I'm just carrying.
I can carry
something.
A whole amp.
Yeah, it's just so there have been like just moments like that.
Yeah.
And maybe that's not necessarily because of my gender. Maybe it's because of my size. I don't know. But there are definitely moments when people say to me, like, I didn't really envision that voice coming out of you. And again, that could be a size issue, but I take it also as like a gender issue, mm-hmm. like because I have a fairly large voice, and a lot of people I think expect me to sound like an artist like Birdie or mm-hmm. you know someone with a like a lighter voice.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I get a lot of that. I get a lot of I think stereotyping that way. To be honest with you, the main struggle I have as a female musical artist is to try to not ostracize my potential male audience because I grew up listening to Tori Amos and Ani DeFranco and like, you know, Alanis Morissette and very, very angry females,
sure.
I would say. And I respect that and I love that and that's what inspires me, but I don't necessarily want to be that so as to ostracize, you know, certain males that might be like, hey, I'm a good guy, you know?
why are your songs making you feel bad?
At me?
What's
yeah.
up?
I'll hold the door open for you.
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah, I think that that's my main struggle. I haven't personally, fortunately, experienced a lot of sexism mm-hmm. yet. Maybe I'm just not at that level and I have that to look forward to.
Yeah. So then let's talk about the big news. the new music, the new
yeah.
single.
Yes.
Which if you're listening to this the day this comes out, which is September 12th, 2016, is yes. the day it drops.
Yep.
How did this new piece come about in the current incarnation?
This came about totally out of necessity because, you know, the band had broken up for various reasons and I was kind of left alone. And also my marriage had broken up and I was extremely alone. And I thought, you know, the one thing I cannot let go is writing and my music. And enough people have been so wonderful and so supportive that they've been like, you know, when can we hear the next thing? And so I basically, with the help of Devin, learned all there was to learn about Ableton Live and machine beats. And I just took a song that everyone loved. It was always our closer. It's called War Torn. And I remixed it, basically, using very few real instruments. Mm-hmm. There's some piano on there, but everything else is really electronic. And my voice. And totally revamped it. And I'm really excited with how it came out. In the new instrumentation of it, new meanings kind of came out, which were extremely therapeutic for me. Mm-hmm. And so now when I play it live, everybody's like, oh my gosh, it's a totally different song. And they still love it, fortunately. But it's kind of more of like a dance tune. It's like really you could hear it in a club almost, which uh-huh. is kind of shocking given what the last album was.
It's a very different face and a very different sound. But
yeah.
That is the thing that I think we've even covered in this short time we're talking here is that clearly you're continuing to evolve to maybe find where you really feel comfortable as a musician.
Right.
Is this that or?
Yeah, I think definitely. I loved collaborating and I loved writing with people, but I'm an only child. I get more done on my own.
Sure.
You know, and sure. so as a result of being alone and just, you know, having my own little studio, I've gotten so much done. I've written so much more. You so much has happened that it's just kind of like, bleh, you know, regurgitating all this uh-huh. stuff. So I feel comfortable producing more work. You know, when I'm working, I feel that I'm at my best. And a lot of times with other people, you're waiting around. You know, you're waiting for them to become available and you're waiting for inspiration to strike. Woody Allen says, you know, you got to show up to write
yep.
every day. And
every
so
day.
That's kind of what I've been doing, and I feel really good about it. I feel like I've kind of come into my own through this.
So you've got the single ready.
Single's ready.
And so I'll ask the annoying question that you've been getting. So what's next? Do you have more stuff ready to go? Do you have something?
I do. I have another single mm-hmm. that's in my little pocket.
Uh-huh.
And actually, I love War Torn, but I actually Trade Off is the other single that's going to come out, and I love Trade Off because I think it's some of the best lyrics that I've written, and it kind of came about in a cool way. Cameron wrote the arrangement and emailed it to me. It was a voice memo on his phone, and I was like, this is brilliant, and I wrote to it, and it's the only time we ever wrote separately.
Sure.
So again, I took his arrangement and just like revamped it and kind of created this very trance-like tune. Devin calls it my drugged out trance tune.
Okay.
You could be really high and like just kind of bob your head to it.
So you seem to be just kind of moving more into the electronic world
yeah.
where you can create the exact soundscape that you want
yeah.
without any limits at all.
Yes, exactly.
So maybe an album next year or...
Yes. I'm going to say this because it'll give me a deadline. I would like there to be an album before next year.
Okay.
Maybe an EP.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'll give myself a little leniency. But I really just want to keep churning it out and just putting it online. You know, it's so different now. It's not touring. It's not playing. It's not even really playing shows.
Yeah.
It's get your work done, put it online, have as many people listen to it as possible.
And let it go where it may.
Exactly.
My thanks again to Emily for stopping by. Be sure to go check out the new song over on Bitch Media and follow her on Twitter at Emily Dangerband. And as she said, she is not the dominatrix. That's the wrong feed you're looking at. Now, before we wrap the episode, I do, of course, have your weekly Ear Fuel listening assignment. For those of you new to the podcast, each week I assign an album to listen to in full, beginning to end, without any distractions or interruptions. It stems from the fact that these days, music has been largely relegated to a background task for most people. You're at the gym, you're driving, you're at work, whatever. And this assignment is about taking some time each week to consciously listen to music for the sake of music alone. Now this week, your assignment is one of the great forgotten classics of music. It's Eddie Hazel's funk-filled 1977 masterpiece, Game, Dame, and Guitar Thangs. If you don't recognize the name Eddie Hazel, you no doubt know his sound, as he's responsible for a number of the most iconic guitar recordings ever, including a legendary solo called Maggot Brain. Yeah. He's the one doing lead guitar on the legendary Funkadelic track, and those in the know cite him as one of the most dynamic and outright talented players ever. But this album is well after his time in Funkadelic, though it shares many elements both musically as well as the personnel. I mean, everyone from Bootsy Collins to Michael Hampton to Bernie Worrell make musical appearances on this record, and George Clinton himself produced a few tracks. But all across the record, Hazel sounds more relaxed and in his element than ever. From deep, slow grooves to upbeat burners, this album is beyond enveloping, and you really can't help but groove along the whole time. The songs were clearly allowed to develop as they wished in kind of the jammy style, and it's in these more exploratory moments where some of the finest parts of the album are achieved. But don't let the idea of a jam band turn you off, because this record is loaded with hooks and grooves that'll keep your butt moving the entire time. It's one of those albums that you can't help but, you know, bob your head or dance along to. And given the lineup of musicians here, it's bound to happen. I mean, you basically have the best funk players of all time on the same record. But there's no question that Eddie Hazel remains the focus and star of this record as he pushes the funk and soul sounds forward, again, creating this musical freedom that you can feel. There's the almost Hendrix-esque tone on So Goes the Story, and it plays perfectly along the softer, more funked out What About It. And the fact that he can play brilliantly against pretty much any sound is all the proof you need to his stature amongst the greatest guitarists ever. For me, though, it's actually the two tracks that appeared on the reissues that make this album special. Lampok Boogie and From the Bottom of My Soul represent 25 minutes of pure musical awesomeness. And you can hear everything from blues to soul to punk to everything in between just in these two tracks. In many ways, Game, Dames, and Guitar Thangs is the portrait of an artist comfortably in his element and firing perfectly on all cylinders. It's a masterclass in guitar, and yet also manages to come off as an irresistible journey through grooves. This record is also one of the more sought after on vinyl, as it had a really small release and then quickly went out of print. There are some very limited edition CD reissues, but if you can find an original on vinyl, do not pass it up. Really. The bottom line is, this is one of those hidden gems that everyone needs to know. Go track it down right now, turn up the groove, and enjoy. Thank me later. So that's all for this week. Again, go check out the new track from Emily Danger, and you can hit me on Twitter about it at GetEarFuel and at The Daily Guru. As always, the podcast is available in the iTunes and Google Play stores, along with at GetEarFuel.com. That is your weekly Ear Fuel. Share and enjoy.